Chapter 41
Lordy, lordy, look what just rolled in off the trash pile. I thought you was dead and buried, Willie boy.
The speaker was big, a slab of sloppy meat with thick legs and a square head stuck on either end. A cap of sweaty iron-gray hair hung limply on a scalp mottled with sunspots that spilled down to his forehead like tiny, irregular copper pennies. His brown suit had walked out of the 1930s in decent shape, but the decade tacked on to that journey had rendered it as limp and irrelevant as a politician's promise.
"Well, hello, Carl," said Dash, removing his hat. "Funny seeing you here."
Carl Pickett tugged a toothpick out of the gap between his front teeth and scrunched his nose back like a dog does before he takes a bite out of your leg.
"That's Chief Pickett to you."
"Okay, Chief Pickett. How goes it?"
Pickett glanced over at two men dressed more slickly than he was, but their youthful countenances together didn't relay a significant thought between them. They stood there, their hats tipped back on low foreheads and their elbows on the front desk, behind which Mabel Dawson stood. The woman looked like if a gun were handy, they would all be heading to see the coroner for a final checkup. Pickett said,
"Boys, this is the mighty Willie Dash. You might have seen his billboards all over town. His hair wasn't that dark 10 years ago. He must have stumbled on the fountain of youth, right, Willie?"
Pickett stuck the toothpick back in the slot and waited. Willie looked at Dawson.
"I'm truly sorry for your loss, Mabel. What a tragedy."
She sniffled and looked down at some papers lying in front of her.
"Thank you."
Dash turned to Pickett.
"So we came to get up to speed on the Fraser murder. Poke around, ask our questions. I'm sure you have no problem with that."
Pickett rolled the toothpick out of the gap to the right side of his mouth, and then to the left, and all the time he was staring at Dash like the man could not have said what he just had.
"What you can do is turn around and march your fat ass right out of here, Dash, and take your little boy with you. This ain't amateur hour. Do I take that as a no to my request?" "You can take it any ways you want, so long as you shove it sideways up where the sun don't shine."
The twin gumshoes thought this was mightily funny, and yodeled over it long enough to where Pickett finally had to shoot them a glance to silence the forced merriment. Dash took his time edging up to Pickett, like a snake drawing mesmerizingly close to its prey.
"A very important man in town has engaged me and my associate to look into this matter, Chief Pickett. But not to worry if you got a problem with that. Hey, Mabel, let me borrow your phone, hun. I got a call to make."
The toothpick froze right under Pickett's left incisor as he took a moment to process this new development.
"Bullshit," he said.
"Right, Mabel, just pass it to me, thanks."
She handed the phone across, and Dash picked up the receiver and dialed a string of numbers from memory with Pickett watching. Finally, on the fifth number dialed, the police chief stuck his finger in a digit hole to prevent the dial from rotating back to where it had started, effectively stopping the call. Dash looked up at him and smiled.
"So you know Sawyer Armstrong's number by heart, too. How fascinating."
"What do you want?"
"I've already relayed my request."
"What's your interest in this?"
"My interest is my client's."
"Sawyer Armstrong really is your client?"
"You know I can't divulge that."
"You already did, asshole."
"Maybe. Maybe not."
Pickett eyed Archer.
"Who the hell are you?"
"Archer."
"Is that your name or occupation, dipshit?"
"Both, depending on the need."
Pickett leaned back against the counter and assumed a friendlier expression.
"Yeah, go on ahead, Willie. I remember when you used to know what you were doing, before the bottle kicked in. Worst thing you ever did was marry Connie. She cut your balls right off."
Dash put the phone receiver back in its cradle.
"We're divorced."
"Yeah, right. You see her every day, I'm told."
"Well, thanks for keeping such a watchful eye on me, Chief. It's much appreciated."
"Uh-huh. Run along, you damn gumshoe, before I change my mind. I suppose you got uniforms up there? And a suit, too. Just tell him I said it was okay. You can still spook people, Willie, and good for you.
And if it gets real queer, just throw that rug you're wearing at him. They might think it's a skunk and run for it. And the body is still there? It's been quite a few hours. Mortimer was out of town. Didn't get here till a bit ago. So hold your noses, gents. The lady don't smell too good.
Dash eyed Dawson, who let out a sob at this insensitive remark. He gestured for her to follow them. The three headed down the hallway. Dawson looked distraught and was blowing her nose into a hanky. She wore a long, dark blue silk robe that fit her like a bulky potato sack, with no potatoes in it.
"I still can't believe it," said Dawson. "I mean, she was so young."
She shot Dash a sudden look.
"But you were here talking to her yesterday. Something's up, and she was killed for it, right?"
she added in an accusatory tone.
"Well, you came out of your grieving at full stride," noted Archer.
She glared at him.
"I don't take crap from anybody, especially men."
"Now just calm down, Mabel," said Dash soothingly, "and tell us what you know as we head on up there."
"I can't see that body. I can't see it again. The cops made me identify her. Oh my God, I've never..."
"You won't have to. So tell me about last night, okay?"
"Like I told Archer here, Ruby didn't show up to do her act. I had his friend Liberty Callahan sing in her stead. We had looked everywhere for the girl. I mean everywhere, and then..."
"Yeah, so just slow down right there," said Dash, "because this is important. When did you last see Ruby yesterday?"
"Cops asked me that. It was around 8 o'clock. She came to get dinner. We have a separate room for the staff to eat their meals."
"Did you talk to her then?"
"No, I was just finishing up my meal with somebody."
"Pretty late for dinner," noted Archer.
"This place gets rockin' later. We're usually not even a quarter full until 9. It is called Midnight Moods, after all."
"What time do you close?" asked Archer.
"We don't, officially. But most people are gone by 3 a.m.
"Geez, don't people sleep around here?" said Archer.
Dash interjected.
"Did she seem upset? Was she alone?"
"No, and yes."
They headed up the stairs.
"When did you know something was wrong?"
"When the cops showed up after midnight. They came tearing in here saying they got a phone call about a dead woman, Ruby Frazier."
Dash didn't look at Archer when she said this, and Archer kept his eyes on a spot on the ceiling.
"Then what?"
"They asked me where the body was. Hell, I didn't know anything about a body, so I took them up to her room. That's when they found her, and then made me take a look."
She shuddered.
"I know there are evil people in this world, and maybe I've run into more than my share of them. But what they did to that poor girl, that takes the cake."
"Funny way to say it, but I get your meaning," said Dash. "Then what?"
"Then all hell broke loose. People running around, cops everywhere. And then, like the chief said, the coroner showed up a bit ago to tell us what we already knew about poor Ruby."
"I understand Sawyer Armstrong was here last night with two of his boys."
Dawson shot a glance at Archer and his injuries.
"He might have been, yeah."
"He was," said Archer.
"Okay, he was."
"Why was he here other than to paint Archer's face purple and yellow?" Dash asked.
"He owns the place. He can come and go when he damn well likes."
"You ever see him with Ruby?"
"No, never,"
she said quickly.
"So you saw Ruby at 8. Have any idea where she went after that?" asked Dash.
"No, she was supposed to be on at 10. She normally comes backstage about a half hour or so early to warm up. But she didn't show, and the stage manager came and told me. I went up to her room thinking she might have overslept or something, but she wasn't there."
"So at 20 or quarter to 10, she was not in her room?"
"That's right,"
replied Dawson.
"Then you and the cops found her a little after midnight. So in 4 hours or so, she went from breathing to dead. And in 2 hours or so, she went from wherever she was killed to her room?"
"That's right,"
Dawson said again.
"Did you talk to anyone who might have seen her?"
She shook her head.
"After I saw her, like that, I went to my room and killed half a bottle of bourbon. It felt like I was drinking water."
"I thought you said you didn't touch the stuff," said Archer.
I was talking about rum, Archer. Bourbon and gin are just fine, thank you very much.
And what sorts of questions did Pickett ask? Said Dash.
Same as you.
Funny, he has junior detectives to do that for him. Why is he here, then?
How the hell am I supposed to know?
Thought you knew everything that went on here. She shot Archer and his injuries a glance.
Not everything.
They reached the room where a young uniformed cop stood guard. Dash took out his license.
Chief Pickett sent us up here to have a look.
The cop looked startled but stepped back.
Okay.
Dash turned to Dawson.
Take a load off, Mabel. You look like you could use it.
She sat in a chair just inside the door while Archer headed into the kitchen to see a dead woman all over again. Chapter 42. It was tougher the second time around, concluded Archer. He had seen violent death in the war and while in prison. After a while, you didn't exactly get used to it, but it took you a shorter time to get over it. Until the next time came. But this was different. This was a kitchen with a small refrigerator, a cooktop, a rug on the floor, and a cuckoo clock on the wall that he hadn't noticed before. And a nearly decapitated young woman sitting in a chair. And now the body had started to decompose and smell, and turn a color that no one would want to look at for long when it was stuck on a human being. And the smell was as bad as one would expect. Thankfully, someone had opened the window.
Hello, Ern,
Dash said to the small man in his late 30s standing in front of Fraser with his fingers tucked into his vest. The man's suit was blue serge, the tie partially undone, the hair grizzled and unkempt, sticking out from under his brown fedora. But the green eyes were intense and searching. Ern looked over, poked a cigarette into his mouth, and lit it. With a grin, he said,
Willie, how'd you get past the chief? Don't tell me he had a stroke when he saw your puss.
Archer, this here is Ernie Prettyman, the best homicide detective north of San Luis Obispo. Ernie, this is Archer.
Prettyman came over to them, and they all shook hands.
Prettyman said, as a mixed compliment on any day, What are you doing here?
We were talking to this poor woman yesterday in connection with a case.
Who's the client?
Someone prominent and with some problems.
No more than that, you can tell me?
I could, and then I'd lose my ticket. And what would be the point of that?
Still, said Prettyman, whatever you can dish out.
It was a confidential client matter, said Dash, that we're following up. But if we find something that will help lead to her killer, I'll make the call for you.
I guess that's the best I can do, then.
Of course, Pickett would just send in Big Steve and club it out of me.
Prettyman frowned.
We don't do that anymore, Willie. At least on my watch.
You're not always on watch, Ern. But to answer your question, Pickett told me to come up here and look around.
Must be growing soft in his old age.
Dash said.
I knew just how to ask.
What can you tell us? As you can see, somebody nearly cut her head off. No blood here. She was killed somewhere else. How the hell she got in here, who knows?
Dash looked skeptical.
Nobody saw anything? Place is pretty big, with lots of people coming and going.
He glanced at the window.
And I doubt someone carried her in through the window over their shoulder.
Right, but there's this. She was last seen around 8 having dinner. Body was discovered after midnight. But whoever called it in did so at about 9 or 10 minutes before 12. So the window is narrowed. Only at that time of night, all the girls were out of their rooms and doing their things downstairs. And this is the top floor, and Mabel Dawson told me there are only 6 gals up here. And those gals were all working last night from 6 o'clock on. They hand out the smokes and the whiskey and help run the card club, and let the guys grab their asses as they go by for tips later. Fraser was the only song and dance performer up here, so her being alone on this floor before her act started wasn't unusual.
I understand they have friends visiting the gals here in the afternoon, said Dash. When we came by yesterday, the parking lot had quite a few cars. Even saw some prowlers in the mix.
He gave Prettyman a look. The man eyed him in understanding.
Que sera, sera.
Murder weapon?
No, but whatever was used was as sharp as my wife's insults.
How long did Mortimer think she'd been dead when he examined her?
He thinks she was killed between 10 and midnight.
Understand he didn't get here until this afternoon, though.
That's right. He was out of town, and we don't like to move the body until he makes the call. But he was pretty sure of the timing based on the body's condition, and he did a pretty thorough exam.
Not a job for the squeamish, noted Archer.
Prettyman nodded and said, When'd you start working with Willie?
Yesterday.
Nothing like hitting the ground running.
Witnesses?
Asked Dash.
I've spoken to nearly all the staff. No one saw a body being moved into this room, I can tell you that. And I can't find anyone who saw Fraser after she left dinner. She could have come back up here or gone out. But if she went out, you'd think one of the valet boys would have seen her, and none did. And she didn't have a car, so somebody would have had to pick her up.
How about out the back? Said Archer.
That's certainly possible, conceded Prettyman. But why go out the back?
If she was meeting someone she didn't want anyone to know about, said Dash. And just so you know, Sawyer Armstrong was here last night, with two of his associates.
They weren't here when the first cop showed up, at least no one reported that they were.
Funny thing about reports, said Dash. They sometimes leave out more than they put in. Anything strike you looking around?
Yeah, she was a slob, and the fridge was empty, and the cooktop doesn't look like it's ever been used.
Mind if we look around?
Go ahead, Willie. I need to go check in with Pickett.
And why is he here when you're here?
Ask him. Only, I advise you don't.
Advice I'll take.
After Prettyman left, Dash pushed his hat back and squatted down in front of Fraser.
She's in rigor mortis now, he said as he tried to bend one of her arms. That dovetails with Mortimer's calculation.
He gazed more closely at the wound.
Damn. That is a hell of a way to kill someone. One stab to the heart would have done it. Why do it like that?
And how do you cut someone's throat like that and no one hears her scream?
Take a look at her right arm, Archer, and the crook of the elbow.
Archer drew closer and saw the small bump of red with a pinprick in the middle.
Someone shot her up with something to knock her out. He glanced sharply at Dash. But you said she was a drug user. She could have done that herself.
Dash shook his head.
I see her as a pill popper. Needle folks have tracks long as my arm. That's the only one on her. Somebody else did it. Depending on what it was, Mortimer may find it when he checks her stomach.
You think Prettyman saw the red bump?
I would be surprised if he didn't, considering I trained him.
Archer's jaw eased down in surprise.
He was a Seamus before a cop?
3 years. I brought him on a couple years after I got here. He left and joined the police force when I had to take a leave of absence. That's why he's so nice to me.
Why did you take a leave of absence?
None of your business.
Dash walked around the space, taking in both small and large details.
Got a question, said Archer.
Shoot.
How come I don't see any fingerprint powder anywhere?
That's right. You mentioned Irving Shaw told you about fingerprints.
There's none on the doorknobs coming in or out? None in here, even though you'd think the killer might have touched the table, the chair, or something else? Prettyman seemed like a stickler for procedure, but he didn't mention it.
Aaron's a good man who wants to keep his job.
Is that supposed to be an answer?
I'll leave it up to you to muddle. Anything else you need to tell me?
Yeah. Last night Dawson told me that Ruby liked men. Rich men. She thought she might have gone off with one of them.
Well, why don't we go ask her about it?
Chapter 43 Dawson was not in the front room when they walked back in there. They headed down the stairs. Fortunately, Pickett was no longer in the reception area as they made their way to Dawson's office. She was seated at her desk, a bottle of gin sitting in front of her. She was staring at it like it was the second coming of Jesus. She looked up when they appeared.
Ah, damn it, can't you leave me in peace?
She moaned.
Dash sat in the chair across from her.
So Ruby liked rich men, huh?
Dawson poured out 3 fingers of the gin and slowly spun the cap back while glaring at Archer.
She poured in a smidgen of tonic, drank down a finger, tongued her lips, and said,
What young woman doesn't?
Don't play that game with me, Mabel. I'm trying to find a killer.
What do I know about anything?
I think a lot more than you let on.
She let out a sigh so long it seemed to Archer like her dying breath. She lit up a Camel and blew smoke all over Dash, who just sat there and absorbed it like a sponge.
You private dicks are all alike. Nag, nag, nag. Mark my words. In another life, you're coming back as some poor schmuck's mother-in-law.
That's a good description, actually. So, rich men? She tapped ash and polished off a second finger, holding the glass to her forehead after, as though she might get the final liquid dollop inside her via absorption.
Tell me who your client is.
Dash didn't hesitate. You already know.
How?
We came here yesterday and pretty much told Ruby who it was, and there's no way you didn't get that out of the girl, because as soon as we left, you had a little talk with her, didn't you? I mean, you said that was your job, the girls. She took another puff of her smoke and eyed the man wearily.
I know what you're thinking, and maybe what you want me to say, but I never saw Douglas Kemper with Ruby, not once. She wasn't in his class. She was a kid from Kansas or Missouri or one of those places with more cows than people.
So she did tell you we were asking about Kemper?
She did.
Thanks for clearing that up. And she told us she was from Illinois, but they got cows there too, so go ahead. What else?
She was pretty. She had a decent voice, and she was okay playing the dumb broad in the comedy skits. And that was it. She was not the second coming of Carol Lombard, trust me. She didn't have the brains or ambition for moving high up the social ladder.
We heard different, at least about her and Kemper.
Then you heard wrong, as far as I'm concerned.
What if his wife thinks he might have been cheating with Ruby? Said Dash.
Then maybe she knows something I don't. But if she can't keep her man happy, it's her problem, not mine.
Can you think of anyone who might want to hurt Ruby? Asked Archer.
We get all kinds in here. Drunks, powder puffs, big men, small men, weak men, and mostly men who think way too much of themselves. But as far as I know, we don't have gents who like chopping a girl's head off, and I hope we never do.
Well, you have at least one, pointed out Archer, drawing a glare from Dawson. Was Ruby seeing anybody, rich or not? Asked Dash.
Truth is, she didn't have nobody special. Working here doesn't really allow for that, does it? Part of the job is making all the men feel special. Hard to do that if you're gaga over somebody. Takes away your, generous spirit.
I thought she was a performer on the stage, not a bedspring squeaker, replied Dash. And maybe she was making one guy feel special and then she stopped and he didn't like it, opined Archer.
Well, I have no clue as to who that might be. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have some serious drinking to do.
Outside in the sunshine, Dash looked around and said, I remember when this was just an empty field. I guess it's good business for Sawyer Armstrong. He's always been able to sniff out the dollars. You said you've known him a long time. Sometimes I think too long. With him, one minute it's honey, the next a shotgun. Archer rubbed his injured face. It was pretty easy for me to figure that out last night. That was just him sniffing around the shrub, seeing if someone dropped something of value, Archer. Don't read too much into it. He really didn't like that we questioned his daughter. I'm sure he didn't, especially seeing as how she thinks her hubby is guilty as charged. And that might derail Kemper's mayoral run, you mean? Well, I could see Armstrong thinking that way, sure. With Ruby dead, you think the newspapers will get wind of this? I think whoever killed Ruby certainly hopes so. Again, to queer Kemper's shot at the mayor's office? Maybe. You don't sound sure. We've been working this case for one day. I'm not sure of a damn thing, except that Mabel Dawson knows more than she's letting on. Let's take a walk around back.
The rear grounds were made up of upper and lower terraces, paved courtyards, open spaces, and private ones rimmed with hedges, along with tables, chairs, chaises, freestanding umbrellas to shield the sun's rays, and a large fountain on the top terrace that bled water down into a series of cast stone pods to form a gentle waterfall,
that somehow ended in a fire pit before the water was recirculated to the top. At this hour of the day, there were few patrons back here, but some of the staff were wiping off the furniture, and others were restocking a large bar set on wheels that sat under a large circus tent-sized pavilion. Dash said, "At least two main doors that I can see leading out to the top terrace, but I'm sure there are more. Service entrances in particular are not always visible, and they like it that way. Tradesman's entrance is on the left side." They walked over to a thin, reedy man with short white hair and a mottled complexion. He wore dark pants and a white-collared shirt, and he was wiping down the furniture. Dash flashed his license and said, "Besides the main doors up there, how else could someone who works here get out without being noticed?" The man pointed to a paved path to the right of the upper terrace that curved past a row of green hedges. "Up there is where we come and go. Boss don't like the hired help taking the main door except for the hostesses and the waiters and waitresses. Us riffraff got to hide if we can manage it. We ain't good enough to be seen, apparently, by the patrons here." He plucked a cigarette from behind his ear and lit up before he grinned a gap-toothed grin. He smelled of smoke and garlic and sweat.
"You hear about that gal Ruby? Got her throat slit, somebody said.
Did you know her?"
The man shook his head and puffed on a cigarette.
"Look at me. Gal like that wouldn't give a guy like me the time of day."
"So you knew who she was?"
"Sure. Seen her around."
"And did the fact that she wouldn't give you the time of day make you mad?" said Dash.
The man's grin faded, and his skin turned a soupy gray.
"Hey, fella, I had nothing to do with what happened to her. I don't even work evenings. I was home with the missus."
"Name?"
"Tom. Tom Boswell."
"Address?"
14 Ocean Way.
"You on the water?" asked Archer, as he wrote this down, and then ran his eye over the man's plain clothes.
Dash said, "The street names in Baytown are funny, Archer, and not in the way you might think. Ocean Way is close to the ocean, the way the earth is close to the sun."
"That's a fact," said Boswell. "And the town dump is at the end of a road called Tuxedo Boulevard."
"Do you know anybody who might have had a beef with Ruby?" asked Dash.
Boswell shook his head.
"No, I don't know nobody that knows her. I work out here for the most part, not inside."
"So you wouldn't know if she had any enemies or boyfriends?"
"No, sir."
"Ever see anybody talking to her?"
"No, sir."
A boy in a cap and buttons ran up to them waving a piece of paper.
"Mr. Dash?"
Dash nodded.
"That's me, kid."
The boy handed him a note.
"This is for you."
Then he turned and hustled away. Dash opened the note and read it.
"Well, Archer, we've been summoned by the king."
"The king? I thought we were a democracy, not a monarchy."
"In a few years, you'll change your mind. You just need more seasoning."
As they walked off, Archer said, "So is it Sawyer Armstrong?"
"Who else? Now if his goons come after you again, don't lose your temper. This meeting might turn out to be very informative for purposes of our investigation."
"And how exactly am I supposed to handle it if they do come after me?"
"Hell, I know Tony and Hank. You're younger and in a lot better shape than they are, Archer. Just outrun the sons of bitches."
Chapter 44 The drive up would have given Liberty Callahan a heart attack, thought Archer, as he piloted the Delahaye around the twists and turns and switchbacks and rising elevations, all while following Dash's directions. They were running on a road parallel to the one the Kemper estate was on, but Sawyer Armstrong had built his home on even higher ground. When the land finally plateaued and they went around a curve, Archer glimpsed a house.
"Is that it? That's Armstrong's place, all right."
After seeing the home he built for his daughter, I thought his residence would look like the Taj Mahal.
"Nope. It's a farm. He grows olives here. Don't know if he makes much money off it. Not that he needs to, but apparently the man has a passion for it."
The home was about half the size of his daughter's, which made it very large indeed, and was constructed of red cedar siding and stone. The yard in front was a sculpted landscape of flower beds,
large native trees and bushes, and a pea gravel path up to the front porch, which had a 100-foot-long tin metal overhang and comfortable chairs, upholstered in wicker, spread along its length. Striped awnings hung over most of the windows on the western side of the house, and Archer could see how they might come in handy when the sun started to set. It would be quite hot and powerful at this elevation and angle. As impressive as the casual house was in size, Archer could see about a dozen large outbuildings behind it, all constructed of red cedar with either shake shingles or tin metal roofs. Farm machinery was neatly parked across this stretch of land. There were horses in corrals and cows in other pens. He watched as men carried various tools, or else drove pieces of equipment designed to help grow or harvest things in the dirt. Stretching out behind all of this was a sea of what Archer surmised were the olive trees. The land seemed to go on and on, right up to the foothills of the Santa Ynez Mountains. He could see lots of people with straw baskets and ladders swarming over the olive orchards. "Are they harvesting the olives?" he asked.
"Yep," replied Dash. "It's tough work. You pick them by hand. Armstrong probably has about 100 pickers here now, those folks you see out there, mostly migrants from Mexico. He doesn't pay them much, but it's a lot more than they can make back home. They live in some of those bunkhouses you see around here. Feeds them, too, before he sends them on their way back across the border."
"Olives grow well around here, I take it?"
"Yes, but it can be tricky. They need a lot of deep, infrequent watering."
"But you can't use salt water?"
"No. Armstrong told me one time the saline burns out the tree roots, and compounds coming from it can be toxic to the leaves."
Archer gazed out at the sea of green, healthy olive trees. "Where does he get his fresh water, then?"
"California has a complicated relationship with water, Archer. Orange growers need a ton of it, the cities need millions of gallons of drinking water every day, and farmers need it for their crops and livestock. There are pipelines and trenches and aquifers and a series of dams and reservoirs collecting water coming off the winter snowpacks in the Sierras and the Cascades, and the Rockies, too. And folks fight over it. Some divert it, others outright steal it from their neighbor or duke it out in court. With regard to Armstrong, he's never divulged his source to me."
They drove up to the house and got out.
"What do you think he wants to see us about?" said Archer.
"I would imagine his son-in-law and his daughter."
"And Ruby Fraser?"
"Maybe. We'll find out soon enough."
A woman answered the door. She was of Mexican heritage, matronly and reserved, and casually attired in denim jeans with the cuffs rolled up and a colorful flannel shirt with a matching bandana. She told them she was Mr. Armstrong's housekeeper, and to follow her. And they did. The floors were polished wood and the walls were plaster. It was far cooler inside than out. Archer figured the walls were thick to make that the case. The interior decorations here were far less formal than at the Kemper's place. They were led all the way through the house and out onto the back porch, which was just as sweeping as the front. At a round table set off to one side sat Sawyer Armstrong. He had on reflective sunglasses, though the sun was not in his eyes, and the man had just clipped off the end of a fat cigar before lighting and then puffing on it. He wore faded jeans, a white shirt, and a dark green corduroy vest. A straw hat with an olive-green band sat on the table. His thick, unruly hair fell nearly to his shoulders. Scuffed boots rode on his long feet. His legs were stretched out. Three glasses and a pitcher of what looked to be sangria were set on the table. And to Archer's surprise, Beth Kemper was also seated at the table, next to her father. He waved them over. They sat and took off their hats, and the housekeeper went on her way. Armstrong poured three glasses and handed them out.
"Nothing like a little Spanish honey in the afternoon," he said, taking off his sunglasses and slipping them into a vest pocket.
Archer looked at Kemper.
"But not for you?"
She wouldn't meet his eye.
"Sangria gives me migraines. My father insists that I learn to love it, but so far it just hasn't worked."
"Love the migraines or the sangria?" asked Archer.
Armstrong interjected, "I think we can move on from the chit-chat." Sounds good to me,
said Dash, as he took out a pack of cigarettes and lit one. He took a puff and said,
You rang, Armstrong? We're here. But before we get going,
he pointed to Archer.
Your boys didn't have to put the hurt on my associate here. That didn't show class.
Archer glanced at Kemper, but she displayed no reaction. To him, the woman was like a flower in full bloom that had wilted to nothing because someone had thrown something toxic on it. Armstrong nodded.
Yes, Willie, I agree with that. And I've had a talk with them both. Good, good. Now, Archer also told me that you want to hire us. Is that why we're here?
In part, yes, said Armstrong after taking a sip of sangria.
But it's more than that, too. There was a girl killed up at my place, Midnight Moods. Pickett himself is on the case, which I take to mean that you called him personally. Otherwise, he'd rather be back in his office banging that honey of a secretary.
Dash glanced at Kemper.
Sorry, Mrs. Kemper, that just slipped out.
She smiled briefly, then lowered her gaze.
You don't have a high opinion of Carl, do you?
Said Armstrong.
I like competence and honesty, and you can throw integrity in there too if you want. Carl fails on all three counts in my book, and I'm sure he feels the same way about me. Only he'd be wrong and I'd be right. I'm not telling you anything I haven't told him.
I see, said Armstrong, in a non-committal tone.
Now we are looking into Ruby Fraser's death, added Dash.
We'd already talked to her because the case we're handling for your son-in-law involved her.
You mean that they were seeing each other?
As I told Archer, it's something that my daughter here can ably handle, though I doubt Beth much cares what Douglas does with his time.
Archer once more looked at Kemper. She finally lifted her gaze to his and said,
I believe I made my position on that very clear to these gentlemen.
Her father patted her on the arm.
And it's your right to do so, of course, Beth. If you remember, I told you to strongly consider not marrying the man. But you inherited your mother's stubbornness, and you went ahead and did it anyway. And now look at where you are.
Archer watched as the pink rose in the woman's cheeks, and not in a good way. She looked angry, but said nothing. Dash said,
Regardless, someone was clearly trying to blackmail Kemper into dropping out of the race and using Fraser to do it. Now she's dead.
Armstrong sat up a little straighter and finished his glass of sangria.
I hope you're not implying that Douglas had anything to do with this girl's murder. I can't say that I like the man all that much, particularly after the way he's treated my daughter, but murder? That's preposterous.
Archer shot Kemper another glance. There was no expression on the woman's features. Archer could not reconcile the vivacious, quick-witted woman in the diner with this dull apparition.
I'm not implying anything, said Dash. I'm just saying that he had an obvious motive to get rid of her, and he didn't have to do the deed himself. There are guys who would do it for him for the right price.
He glanced at Kemper.
Again, I'm sorry. I had no idea you'd be here, but these are things we have to discuss. If you want to leave, this might be a good time.
Archer saw the indecision on the woman's face until Armstrong put a big hand on her shoulder.
Beth is strong. She can deal with this, Willie. Isn't that right, my dear?
Kemper glanced at Archer before saying,
I'm fine. Mr. Dash, please carry on.
All right, ma'am, if you're sure.
Armstrong said, I don't agree with that theory at all, Willie. Because now that she's dead, people will assume that Douglas did have something to do with it. And while adultery is not a good look for a politician, murder is far worse. So don't you see that this is an attempt to push the election to Alfred Drake?
So you really think Drake had her murdered? Said Dash,
each word draped in more sarcasm than its predecessor.
No, but politicians have backers, and Drake has his.
And who are Drake's backers?
Armstrong sat forward, looking pointedly animated now.
You should nose around about money men from Vegas, and mob types from New York, who want to set up shop in Baytown, Santa Barbara, Frisco, L.A., and San Diego. There is a narcotics trade, Willie.
That is very lucrative for the mob, and a lot of it comes over the border and over the water. These folks are invading this country, and nothing is stopping them so far.
Yeah, did you happen to mention that to Carl Pickett? Because he doesn't even have a single police boat on the water. Maybe he likes the stuff coming in. Maybe he gets something from it. Maybe that's how he can buy big-ass Chryslers and toothpicks by the bushel on a policeman's salary.
Armstrong sat back, looking surprised.
Are you accusing the chief of police of taking bribes?
Not at all. I think he slipped and fell on the street and a bunch of money ended up in his pocket. But if you tell him I said so, I'll deny it.
Armstrong waved this comment away.
I don't care about Pickett at the moment. I care about this election. And I don't want to see my son-in-law's chances go down the tubes because someone is trying to frame him.
The son-in-law you don't much care for? Said Archer.
Armstrong leveled his gaze at him.
I don't have to like the man to like his politics. Douglas will be a good mayor, and more to the point, he is the man we need at the moment. And I consider Alfred Drake to be certainly a socialist, and perhaps a communist. He would be a disaster for this town. You mentioned to Archer here that you wanted us to find the truth no matter where it went. It didn't sound like you had a dog in the hunt, Armstrong, but now it sounds like you do. So which is it? I'd like to know before deciding on your offer of engagement.
Armstrong smiled and looked at his daughter.
I forgot how good Willie is at chess, Beth. I think he might have captured one of my pawns and one of my knights, and he's now bearing down on my queen. Is there an answer in there somewhere?
Noted Dash.
Look for the truth, Willie. And I do have a dog in the hunt, yes. But I'm confident of where the trail will lead you. How's that for an answer?
I guess it'll have to do, because I doubt another one will be coming along.
Dash took a sip of the sangria and wrinkled his nose.
You don't care for it?
Asked Armstrong.
I'm not much of a punch man. You introduce sweetness into alcohol, you've pretty much lost me. Liquor should burn, make a man feel alive. Otherwise, you're just drinking something so you can piss it away an hour later. So you had a look at the list we got from Kemper. Anyone on it look promising?
I'm not a detective.
Just your gut, then.
I think the list is pretty much worthless.
Interesting.
Dash rose and put on his hat. Archer did likewise.
So when did you and your boys leave Midnight Moods last night?
Right after our little encounter with Archer. You can check with the valet if you don't believe me.
Okay, I will. You remember which one it was?
A man in a valet's uniform looking for tips, and drunk women leaving alone.
Thanks, that pretty much describes all of them, but it's a start.
That's quite a place you built for the Kempers, noted Archer, while looking directly at Beth Kemper.
I built it for my daughter,
said Armstrong. He put a protective arm around Kemper.
Douglas just came along for the ride.
But you're backing your son-in-law for the mayor's race, said Dash.
One does not have to love one's allies, Willie.
One just has to use them. Chapter 45. When they finally arrived back at the office, the sun was dipping into the horizon and turning the dark ocean water salmon and gold in the process. Archer said,
Didn't that seem weird to you back there?
Beth Kemper didn't act anything like herself.
Her old man takes up the whole universe when he's in the room.
They got out of the car and Dash said,
I've got some things to do, Archer. See you in the morning, bright and early this time, but here's what I want you to do.
He leaned back through the open window.
Tonight, head back over to Midnight Moods and see and hear what you can. Go over the room again and see what occurs to you. Talk to folks. I find it hard to believe that no one saw anything last night.
Will do, Willie.
Is Connie gone, do you think? I was going to head up to the office for a minute. Dash checked his watch, dipped his hand into his pocket, and came up with a key ring with three keys attached. He took one off and tossed it to Archer.
Just don't lose it.
Archer watched as Dash walked off down the street to where he didn't know.
He went into the building to find the elevator car empty. Earl must have gotten off work, too, he thought. He took the stairs up and unlocked the door to Willie Dash's very private investigations. Connie was indeed gone. He closed the door and entered his office and looked around. Small, spare, dowdy even, musty. And my office. He smiled, and spent the next hour cleaning the place up and putting things just so. He almost felt like he was back in prison, where small tasks like this, straightening something, cleaning something, allowed him to get through the day, and the next day, and the next. Finished, he looked out the small window and watched as two men walked down the alley four stories below, smoking cigarettes and sharing a bottle. Archer drove back to the boarding house and knocked on Callahan's door.
Yeah?
She called out. It's me, Archer. He heard footsteps approach. When she opened the door, he found himself a little disappointed that she had so many clothes on.
What?
She said, her hand on her hip, an attitude dripping from her features. You want to grab some dinner?
No, I'm not hungry. Did you find out who killed that girl?
We're working on it, Liberty, but I did have one favor to ask.
Then you better come in. It would be humiliating for you if I turned you down in public.
She sat on the bed, and he leaned against the wall. He could see that she had a number of outfits out on the bed and others hanging on various wall pegs. You going through your wardrobe?
Yeah. What Dawson had for me just didn't work. Luckily, I brought a few things that will.
More than a few. You excited about it?
It's not Hollywood, but it'll do. For now. What's the favor?
I was wondering when you start work there if you could keep your eyes and ears open at midnight moods and report back to me.
You mean act as a spy for you?
Well, that's one way of putting it.
Seems to me like it's the only way, Archer.
It might help us find out who killed that woman. Callahan's hard features collapsed when he said that, and she looked down and started fussing with one of her nails.
Whoever did it didn't have to kill her like that. They didn't have to do that to her.
Archer sat on the bed next to her. If you go all soft on me, I'll think somebody kidnapped the real Liberty and left you behind.
What girls like me do, Archer, what girls like Ruby Fraser did, is hard. We have to navigate 1,000 different things at once, most of them shitty and almost all of them having to do with men. All at the same time we're pursuing our dreams, or at least what we think we'd like to do with our lives. And unlike men, we can do 100 things right and 1 thing wrong, and our dream is over. That kind of gets to you. Makes you light on your feet, unwilling to...
To trust anybody, including men like me. She touched his face.
Does it still hurt?
Not when you rub it like that. Feels good, actually.
I'll be your spy, Archer. And I need you to drive me over there on Friday to sign my contract.
Okay, but you need to be careful. Something's not right at Midnight Moods.
Something's not right with the whole world.
He left her there to continue her wardrobe choices and ate a quick dinner at a place across the street. Steak, peppers and onions, washed down with a beer, and bread hard enough to hammer nails with. Archer walked around the streets for a bit, enjoying the falling temperatures and light ocean breeze, and watched the marine fog build in the hollows leading up to the palaces resting above them. As he walked, he thought about Beth Kemper, visualizing the woman in his mind. The first word that came to him as he did this was fragile. That surprised him, because she didn't appear to be fragile. But he wondered what Beth Kemper's breaking point was. He thought at some point he might get to see it. Having some time before he headed to Midnight Moods, he walked back to the boarding house and retrieved the Delahay. He drove down to the wharf and saw that the boat Armstrong and the others had been on the other night was still tied up to the dock. He sought out and found the harbor master's office. The gray-bearded old man sitting in there had on a thick turtleneck sweater, along with a sailor's pea jacket and a captain's hat. He looked like an advertisement for a seaman's life, at least from Herman Melville's time. He plucked his briarwood pipe from between tobacco-stained teeth and looked up at Archer from the perch in his quarters, which were not much bigger than a phone booth. Hanging on the wall behind him was a nautical chart of the harbor, complete with depth markings, the exact outline of the coast and seabed, along with navigational aids and hazards. Next to it was a picture of a pinup model, who looked a lot like Callahan and was showing about as much leg. Archer pointed out the window at the boat.
That's a nice-looking craft. Does someone own it, or can it be rented?
The man said,
That there is Sawyer Armstrong's vessel.
Sawyer Armstrong? Said Archer, feigning ignorance.
Why, he's the richest man around here. Has a big place up in the mountains, grows olives, but he owns most of Baytown.
Oh, right. I think I've heard of him, but I've only just moved here.
Archer lit up a lucky strike and looked out at the boat.
Where do people go on boats around here? Are there islands and such?
Sure, or Channel Islands.
Channel Islands? Can you get out there fast?
Depends on what you mean by fast, young man, and depends on which island. There's eight of them in what they call an archipelago. Goes from San Miguel to the north to San Clemente on the southern side. Santa Cruz and Anacapra are the closest to us, but you're still talking over an hour or more to get to them.
Are the islands inhabited?
Just Santa Catalina, really. The others are either empty or just have a few folks. Used to be Indians lived in the Channel Islands. Chumash on the northern islands, and the Tongva tribe to the south. But the Spaniards came and moved them out way back when. Now in Catalina, some rich feller built a town out there, like a tourist destination, so to speak. Avalon, it's called. Then he went broke, and some other fellers tried their hand and kept building. Then they had a fire and money problems and had to sell out to other investors. Then that chewing gum feller, Wrigley, came along and bought most everything up. Spent millions out there. So as I heard, Catalina Casino is real popular.
Archer blew out a mouthful of smoke.
Casino? I thought casinos were outlawed in California.
The man chuckled.
Ain't no gambling there. Casino is Italian for gathering place. At least, some feller told me that. Anyway, Wrigley owned the Chicago Cubs. Team used to go there for spring training. Long time ago, I went over there once to watch them. Lot of fun. Then Mr. Chewing Gum died, and his son took over and kept building it up. Then the military came in and took everything over during the war. They still do tests and stuff out there on some of them.
How far is it?
Catalina's part of the Southern Channel Islands chain. Takes you about an hour or so by boat from way down in Long Beach to get there. Whole lot longer from here. Have to make it a full day trip.
I hear there's another island out there, a lot closer to us here. Sort of a man-made place the military put together?
The seaman eyed him suspiciously and tapped the smoking end of his pipe against his desktop.
You hear a lot for someone who just got to town.
I like to keep my ears open.
Is it true?
Military folks did lots of things during the war. We don't know them all, except we never will.
Hush, hush, right? Archer eyed the man's seafaring garb.
So you've never been out there? Thought you'd have been all over these waters.
No reason to go that way.
Can I get out there? Just to see if it's there?
Why would you want to do that?
I like trying new things.
The man shrugged.
You know how to pilot a boat?
I do, yeah. Army taught me.
Funny thing for the Army to teach.
You'd be surprised how much water you encounter in the Army.
It's a straight shot west of here, pretty much from where I'm sitting. 271 degrees in your compass. 3 miles. About 15 to 20 minutes with the typical sea conditions we have here. Don't normally hit heavy water until farther out.
Since you know the compass setting so exactly, then there is an island out there, said Archer.
Never said there wasn't, young feller.
But you've never been there?
The man bit down on his pipe and said nothing.
So the military still owns it? Will I get in trouble if I go out there?
Maybe, but it might not be the military you have the trouble with.
Who, then?
Can't really say, young man, because I don't know. And I don't want to know.
Archer kept his gaze on the fellow, but the man's mouth had closed up like a fish that had swallowed a hook. He eyed the darkening skies.
Can I get a boat out early in the morning, around first light?
Sure. Feller down near the port operations rents them out. You go that way there, you'll see his sign. He's honest. Or as close to it as you're going to get. He opens at 6. $5 is the fee for the day. 8 hours or 8 minutes is all the same. And that includes fuel.
Thanks.
Uh-huh.
Archer walked away. and then glanced back to see the man now standing and staring at him. You might have just made a big mistake. But there might be a way around that. Archer picked up his pace. Chapter 46. The man renting boats was just about to close when Archer reached him. At first, he didn't want to provide Archer a boat so late in the day. But when Archer waved a sawbuck in front of his face and said he was only going about 3 miles out, the man took the bill and said,
"Okay, mister. Just dock it nice and tight in the same slip when you come back, 'cause I ain't hanging around."
Archer filled out the necessary paperwork, and the man led him to the boat with a set of keys and a navigation map of the area. Along the way, he grilled Archer on his seamanship and came away satisfied.
"Even 3 miles out, weather can turn fast, so stay alert. And use your running lights. Shipping lanes out there. It's marked on the map. You don't want to get swamped by a tanker."
"Right, thanks."
"And what's so special about 3 miles out, anyway?"
said the man.
"Nothing but water. Anacapa's a lot farther than that."
"Just checking out a tip I got on a fishing spot." The man eyed him with skepticism.
"Yeah, right. You ain't no smuggler, are you?"
Archer tapped his pockets. "Well, if I am, whatever I'm smuggling is really small." The varnish was so freshly applied and smelled so strongly that Archer felt like he'd been lacquered as soon as he stepped foot on board the trim 19-foot Chriscraft barrelback with an American flag flapping from a post set on the stern. He stowed his hat, powered up the motor, flicked the switch for the running lights, and steered the boat due west. As he sped up, the wind increased, and the ocean followed this nudge, with the result that foot-high seas confronted him about half a mile out. Archer pushed the throttle forward a bit more, and the heavy wooden boat handled the chop with ease. He kept his eye on his compass, and then took a minute to look over the laminated map the fellow had provided, using a flashlight that had been clipped to a holder set on the dashboard. The island he was heading to was not marked on this map. After confirming his route, he put the map away and kept his eye on the compass, holding his heading steady at 271 degrees. He was cruising along at 24 knots and figured he would be at the island in less than 10 more minutes. He let his gaze run from left to right and then behind him, just in case. The seas became heavier at around the 2.5 mile mark, and he throttled down a bit to compensate, working the bow at a 45-degree angle into the oncoming waves to cleave their power in half. The moon was up and visibility was good. Everything was going his way so far. He knocked on the wooden dash for luck. He had learned to pilot powerboats in these very same waters during his training back in 1942. The Army had worked with the Navy, and amphibious landings were going to be in his future, Archer learned. Thus, he had been given the skill set necessary for this, never realizing it would come in handy so many years later, and in American waters. He had been in far worse seas than he was currently in, but like the boat rental man had cautioned, things could change quickly if the weather turned. He slowed the boat as he approached a dark mass rising up out of the Pacific. He swung the light mounted on the side of the boat, much like a prowler's beam, so that it strafed the contours of the island he was heading toward. He turned north and navigated down the island's length, doing a rough calculation of its size and dimensions. Once he had returned to his starting point, he throttled down even more and pointed his bow at an enormous dock that his searchlight had revealed previously. There was another smaller dock about a half mile down on that side. He snagged two fenders and placed them on hooks on the gunwale on the port side to cushion that side of the boat from the wooden dock. He glided in at an angle, then cut the wheel hard toward the dock, killed the motor, and jumped out as the stern swung landward. He quickly tied up the boat, grabbed his hat and the flashlight, and walked off the dock and onto the island. He looked around, aiming the beam here and there. He was also wondering why, if the military still owned this piece of land, no one was here to challenge him for trespassing. He walked in a westerly direction, shining his light over the dirt. The land was reasonably flat, but then elevated to about 40 or so feet as he drew closer to the middle of the island, which made sense to protect against flooding. There had clearly been structures here, large ones, if their remaining foundations were any indication. Like an archaeologist, he could roughly determine what had been there by what had been left behind. He saw discarded cables, stacks of used lumber, chunks of concrete, and an empty crate that had radar stenciled on the side. There were old tires, the remains of a jeep buried in the mud, empty boxes that had been filled with sea rations, a sailor's white cap, an empty ammo chain for a machine gun, and a 50-gallon oil drum that was labeled Property of the United States Navy. A little ways away, he saw the rusted undercarriage of a Mark VI railway gun mounted on a rotating platform. He had seen these guns while training on the Channel Islands. They could move around in a circle and take on both enemy aircraft and ships. Under the illumination of his light, he spotted something interesting. He walked over and knelt next to a hole in the ground with a stake driven in next to it. Some number and letter markings were on the wooden stake, but he didn't know what they meant. This very same thing was also at several other places, all on the elevated portion of the island. Then he saw another post in the ground with a name on it. Lancet Surveyors and Architectural Group, Baytown. There wasn't a phone number or any other information on the post, but he wrote down the name in his notepad. Archer performed a run-fast walk until he reached the water on the other side of the island. He had measured his strides and gauged the island as being about 3 miles in width. He had earlier calculated it was about twice that in length. 3 miles by 6 miles, or 18 square miles in total. Not a lot of land, but certainly big enough to do something with, as the Navy apparently had. And it was an engineering marvel that they had created an island from basically a shallow spot in the ocean. And to his knowledgeable eye, the large dock located here could have handled the biggest destroyers the Navy had. Farther out, there was a long, shadowy form. It took Archer a few moments to figure it out. A breakwater. That would make sense when you were docking ships out this far from the mainland. He looked up at the sky as the blinking lights of a plane buzzed overhead. Its angle of ascent showed that it had probably just taken off from the coast. It continued in a westerly direction, maybe on its way to Hawaii, he thought. To his practiced ear, it was a 4-engine aircraft, and it would need all that horsepower to make it that far. He trudged back to the boat, feeling disappointed. He hadn't really accomplished much of anything, and it had cost him $10. Archer picked up his pace as a flash of lightning appeared far out over the ocean to the west. A storm was rolling in. He jumped into the boat, fired up the engine, untied his lines, and pulled away from the dock. He pointed his bow east and throttled up. He could feel the wind at his back, and then the barometric pressure dropped with a rush. This was nature's warning sign of foul weather coming. He pushed the throttle down further, and the Chris Craft's powerful engine thrust the boat through the increasingly heavy seas. Archer listened to the cracks of thunder as the storm chased him all the way back to the California mainland. He slid the boat into its slip, tied it up, left the key under the seat as the man had instructed him, and hustled back to the Delahaye. He got the top on and the windows rolled up a few seconds before the rain began to fall in buckets. He sat in the car with the engine off and stared out to sea. 3 miles out was an island, and he was pretty sure that that was where Sawyer Armstrong and those other men had gone. Now the question was, why? Chapter 47. Midnight Moods was starting to hit its stride as Archer valeted his car at the front entrance. Apparently a brutal murder of one of its employees wasn't going to interfere with business. People still wanted to drink, dance, gamble, and watch pretty young girls lift their legs and sing their hearts out. The rain had already passed through, but it was still drizzling and about 15 degrees cooler than before the storm had hit. He spotted the valet captain in his hat, buttons, and military-style uniform at the key desk. Archer walked over and held up his PI license. The captain took a long look at the photostat copy. The gent was in his 50s, with thinning gray hair, a handlebar mustache, and a nervous tick in his right eye, which made Archer nervous just watching it. His lips and nails were stained yellow from his smokes. He was every inch of 5'6", and that frame carried about 30 more pounds than it ideally should have.
"Okay, what do you want?"
he asked. "You know Sawyer Armstrong?"
"No, never heard of the guy,"
the man said, sarcasm dripping like the fake medals on his chest.
"Oh, wait a sec. Ain't he the man who owns this place?"
"You can play me for a sap, and this dance will just take longer than you want it to."
"The cops were already here, Seamus. I talked to them, but I don't have to do the same to you, so scram."
We're working with Chief Pickett on this case, so you might want to rethink that position, chum, unless you want a trip downtown that might leave you black and blue, if you get my meaning. The patronizing smile slowly faded from the captain's features.
Okay, don't get all tough. What do you want to know?
Archer put his license away and said, "You have any idea what time Armstrong left last night? He was with two of his associates. They were basically gorillas in neckties, but not as good-looking."
"Yeah, I know them all right. Hank and Tony. Not a pair you want to get on the wrong side of, mister."
"I got that lesson yesterday right here and real good. So you saw them?"
"Yeah, I ordered Mr. Armstrong's car up myself. It's a Cadillac about as long as my house. He got into the back, Hank drove, and Tony sat in the passenger seat. Tony looked like he'd slipped and hit his face against something hard."
"Yeah, he did. So what time was this?"
"Oh, I'd say 11, give or take."
"Give or take how many minutes?"
"Hey, what do I look like to you, buddy, a Timex? It was around 11. They got into the car and drove off."
"Did you know the murdered girl, Ruby Frazier?"
"Just to see her around."
"You ever see her with a guy?"
"That's sort of the point of midnight moods, ain't it?"
"She was a singer, not one of the cigarette and brandy yells or the afternoon boppers." His lip curled back in a sneer.
"Well, excuse me. I didn't mean to speak ill of the dead. I'm sure she was a saint."
"So did you ever see her with a guy?"
"Maybe."
"Douglas Kemper, you know him?"
"Sure, he's here right now playing cards."
"You ever see him with Ruby?"
"Nope. Where's this going, fella?"
"Apparently nowhere. Thanks for nothing, Pops." Archer walked over the drawbridge, checked his hat, and ordered a vodka martini that went down nice after his island-hunting expedition off the coast. He was directed to the card club room by a cigarette girl who did her best to palm off a pack of Camels on him. "I only smoke Lucky Strikes," he said. She looked him up and down and said in a husky voice,
"You don't look like you need that much luck, handsome."
"Damn, I finally run into a gal who gets me and I have to go." He flipped her a quarter and took a pack of Luckies from her tray. A boy in buttons opened the door to the card club room and Archer ducked inside. It was a large space, about 40 feet square, with tables set up nearly chair back to chair back. There was only men in here. Archer didn't know if that was a rule or not. The gentlemen wore expensive suits or high-dollar tuxes. They were smoking cigars, sipping what looked to be snifters of cognac, and looking amusingly content at their privileged status in life. Sitting on a tall stool in the middle of each table was a fellow with a colorful vest, sleeve garters, and a green visor who stood guard over the chute from which the playing cards were dealt. It didn't take Archer long to spot Kemper. He was lounging in a chair behind 5 cards and a pile of chips with 4 other men who looked like clones of his, but without the indifference that oozed from Kemper. None of the men were Sheen. He crossed the room, taking a last sip of his drink, and stopped next to Kemper, who put down a full house, kings over tens, and scooped up the chips in the pot to the chagrin of the rest of the elite herd. Kemper looked up at him and set his Havana in an ashtray. "Archer, right?" He looked around. "Where's Willie?" "He called it a day, but I'm more of a night owl." He knelt down and said in a low voice, "I'd like to ask you a few questions and give you an update if you're interested." Kemper glanced at the other players and smiled. "Okay, boys, I feel sorry for you, so I'm taking my toys and going home. You can duke it out for the few dollars you have left, and you can thank me later." He glanced at the dealer and pointed to his chips. The man nodded. "Yes, sir, Mr. Kemper, I'll take care of it." "Scrape off 50 for your trouble, Harry."
"Thank you, sir."
Kemper rose, and Archer followed him out of the room and over to one of the bars lining the grand hall that bisected the first floor. Archer refreshed his martini, and Kemper opted for a stinger. "Let's take a walk," said Kemper. "I don't really care for crowds while I'm answering questions and getting updated." He led Archer out to the rear terrace and over to a covered area that had been sheltered from the earlier rain. They sat at a wrought iron table with orange and white striped upholstered chairs set around it. The babbling waterfall Archer had seen earlier continued its walk down the terrace, ending in the spitting fire pit. The effect was nifty, thought Archer, if you were into all show and no substance.
"Give me the update first, Archer," commanded Kemper.
Archer took a swallow of his martini before answering, just because he felt like it. He went through what had happened thus far, including the interviews done,
steps taken and information discovered. It was all perfunctory and necessary, and yet Archer just wanted to get beyond it and onto something meaningful. Kemper listened to all of this, and then took about a minute to clip and light up another Havana, puffing thoughtfully to get it primed. He sat back, took a sip of his stinger, and said,
"Wilson filled me in on some of this. Now, I don't like it that you talked to Beth. I told you I didn't want her learning about this garbage.
She was going to learn it whether you wanted her to or not. Better she heard it from us and not some rag." Kemper looked him over but gave no opinion on this. He said,
"Now about this Fraser girl.
What about her?
Any thoughts on who might have killed her?"
"Not yet. Have the cops talked to you?"
"Me? Why would they talk to me?"
Archer had had enough. He put his drink down and took his time lighting a cigarette from his new pack of Luckies. He waved out the match and put it in the ashtray. "Look, I might have just started working with Willie, but I haven't fallen off a turnip truck since I was 5. And to my knowledge, no one's removed my brain. So why don't we just jump over the horse shit and get straight on to one essential fact? Namely, that you had a strong motive to kill the lady. And that means the cops, even the bullshit ones in this town, will want to talk to you at some point."
"You haven't been in town long enough to know if the cops are bullshit.
I'm a fast learner, and it wasn't that hard, actually.
But they don't know about the blackmail attempt on me.
There is no guarantee that will remain the case. And the fact that you hired us to look into it, you think us snooping around will go unnoticed? So why don't you drop your alibi on me and see if it passes muster?"
"I don't like your attitude, Archer. As a general rule, people do not talk to me in that manner."
"Well, as a general rule, most guys I talk to aren't accused of having an affair with a woman who ended up murdered."
"I told you that I wasn't having an affair."
"And you're sticking to that?"
"Yes."
"Do you know what your wife thinks?"
He sipped his stinger before responding, "I know generally."
"Well, specifically, I don't think she believes your side of the story. Now, she probably hopes you haven't cheated on her, but that's all it is, a hope. So if the cops come to question her and she spills what she really thinks, the cops will be headed your way. And that brings us back to, do you have an alibi?"
"Why would they go to her?"
"I'll assume you're not really playing me for a dope and you actually want an answer, so here goes and listen closely. Your wife also has a motive to kill Ruby, and it's one of the oldest ones in the book. She thought she was sleeping with the woman, but she apparently has an alibi. She was at a dinner with friends from 5 to midnight.
His face clouded. "I see. When was the girl killed?"
"Say around 10. Kemper's eyes eased to slits. He finished the stinger faster than he should have and looked around for the cocktail waitress to place an order for an encore. She rushed over, bent low to flash some cleavage, batted her baby blues, and said in response to his order,
"Coming right up, Mr. Kemper."
She swept away, apparently giddy with the prospect of serving the man cognac laced with creme de menthe. Archer, who had watched this interaction closely, eyed the man and said, "All the gals come on to you like that?" Kemper waved his Havana around like it was a wand that would make Archer and all of the man's problems just vanish.
"I'm young, I'm wealthy, I'm well-connected."
"And you're easy on the eyes," interjected Archer flatly, "just in case you were too modest to say that."
"You have a quicker tongue than I initially gave you credit for, Archer. I'm also married to the loveliest, richest woman in town. So, naturally, some gals out there see me as a challenge. Can they get me to violate my marriage vows?"
"So can they?"
"I'm a man, Archer. I'm not saying I'm any better than I am in that regard."
"Okay. Now, hopefully for the last time, do you have an alibi for the time Fraser was murdered?"
"I was with Wilson Sheen. We had dinner at the office, and then we had a meeting there to go over campaign issues. I didn't leave there until well after 11.
"Anybody else vouch for that?"
"No."
"But isn't he enough?"
"You better hope he is."
"And after that?"
"What does that matter? You said she died around 10.
"Just to satisfy my own curiosity."
"I went home."
"Anyone see you there? The Chinaman butler? Adam Stover, the chauffeur?"
"No."
"How about your wife?"
"You said she was at a dinner."
"How about later when you went to bed?"
"We maintain separate bedrooms."
"Why is that?"
"None of your damn business."
"Okay. So you didn't see her at all? Or her car?" No. She might have stayed in town for all I know. Where might that be?
She keeps an apartment in the Occidental building. It's on Sawyer. He smirked.
Of course. She just can't get away from Daddy, can she? It's near the intersection with Carrillo Avenue. She had it before we were married.
Archer tapped out his smoke.
So not much of a marriage, then.
We've had a good run.
I guess you missed the till death do us part section of the negotiation.
Don't give up your day job, Archer. You're not a satisfactory Abbott or Costello.
Come on, Mr. Kemper. The line wasn't that bad. So you ever thought about kids? Sometimes that can make a difference.
Thank you for the marriage advice, Archer. In the future, keep it to your goddamn self.
The waitress brought Kemper's drink and placed it in front of him, as though she were presenting him with the crown jewels, thought Archer.
I hope you like it, Mr. Kemper. And if there's anything you need from me, all you have to do is say it and it's done. And I mean anything.
Yes, you do, thought Archer. He half expected the woman to strip right there. Kemper thanked her with a glance, and she went on her way, smiling broadly. Archer rose.
Well, I'll leave you to your drink and the fawning cocktail waitresses.
I didn't kill that woman, Archer. I really didn't.
Glad to hear it.
Are you?
You're the client. It's not my job to put you in prison.
Really? You strike me as more idealistic than that.
Maybe once. Now not so much.
Archer walked back inside, his work still not done. But then something happened to make him change course. Or, more specifically, she happened.
Baytown was apparently a place where your intentions changed faster than the second hand on a clock.
Chapter 48 Wilma Darling came out of the powder room and strode down the hall. Archer ducked down another hall and then peered back around to follow her trek from powdering her nose. She pulled her gloves back on and drove her heels into the rug like American bayonets into Nazis as she marched to somewhere with a purpose that intrigued Archer. She was dressed all in crimson, and it was tight in all the places that counted. She had done something with her hair to make it even more luxurious, and it danced across her shoulders with every stride. The woman's makeup was immaculate, and from her resolute expression, Archer figured she was on the hunt for something. The target presented itself when Wilson Sheen came walking down the hall in the opposite direction. He was dressed in a white dinner jacket, black bow tie, and dark pants. To Archer, he looked like a head waiter in a ritzy hotel. The short jacket didn't ride well on his wide, overweight frame, but Darling didn't seem to mind. She rushed forward and planted her lips over his, wrapping her long arms around his wide waist, while his hands patted her long, elegant back like a mom attempting to burp an infant. When she pulled back, Sheen's face was coated with her attack, his face as crimson as her dress. He dabbed at the marks with his handkerchief, looking sheepish, though pleased, as a few fellows passed by and gave him the universal male signs of success when hunting down the big game of females. The stupid schoolboy grins, the thumbs up, and the tongues wagging like dogs in need of water, or something. Arm in arm, they ascended the stairs. Midnight Moods apparently did not have an elevator, and Archer followed at a discreet distance. They ventured all the way to the top floor and trekked in the direction of Fraser's old room. Archer kept pace with them, careful to keep his face pointed down and ready at a moment's notice to turn around if need be, though there were a few couples up here who looked to be heading toward the same nirvana that Sheen and Darling were. To his surprise, they entered the room right next to Fraser's, and Darling closed the door behind them. As Archer hustled to the spot, he heard the door being locked. He glanced at Fraser's old room and decided it was worth a shot. The door was fortunately unlocked, and he entered, shutting the door quickly behind him. The body was thankfully gone. Archer found a water glass from the kitchen cabinet and made a beeline to the bedroom, which he figured would back up against the bedroom in the adjacent room. He placed the glass against the wall and his ear against the bottom of the glass. He heard mumbles and heavy breathing and snatches of conversation that he couldn't understand. Something hard tapped against something else, then laughter, then moans, then what sounded like two people disrobing as quickly as they could. Then a radio came on, and he could hear loud music. Then he heard the sounds of bed springs being bounced, and then the movement settled into a rhythmic beat that, while he could appreciate it, helped him not one iota in his investigation. He glanced around, wondering what to do, when he saw the small door in the ceiling, with a short pull cord hovering right at the top. He grabbed a chair, stood on it, gripped the cord, and jerked, pulling down the hinged door. There were no drop-down stairs, but he got a handhold on either side of the opening, did a pull-up, and hoisted himself through. There was flooring up here over the ceiling joists, and a chain with a light bulb at one end. He pulled it, and the light came on, turning darkness reasonably bright. He crawled quietly in the direction of the other apartment until he figured he was over it. Along the way, he found some things that might actually be bona fide clues, but they would keep for now. He found an identical door in the ceiling of the next apartment. With the loud music hopefully covering any sound he made, Archer decided to chance it and very slowly pushed down on the hatch. He got it open about 3 or 4 inches, which gave him a sightline into the room. Darling was on the bed, on her hands and knees. She was wearing nothing except her garter belt and the sheer nylons. Sheen was completely naked, and Archer could see that the man looked just as fat unclothed, maybe more so. His skin was pasty. His chest, shoulders, and back were as hairy as a caveman's without an ounce of visible muscle. He was standing behind Darling and had a tight grip on her firm buttocks. Archer felt embarrassed watching them, and he looked away. Part of him wanted to close the hatch, go back to Fraser's old room, and run like hell. But then he asked himself, what would Willie Dash do? And it wasn't like he was watching out of purely prurient interest, he told himself. He was investigating. And what he was seeing didn't make a lot of sense. And that made him suspicious. He looked back in time to see Sheen's efforts slow, and he began to pant harder. Darling rose up enough for Archer to see her face. And now he was even more intrigued and puzzled. Her expression was a delicate mixture of boredom and disgust. The lady was clearly not there because she was in love with Sheen or found him attractive. Now the question was, why was the lady there? Archer once more averted his gaze, but he kept the hatch open so he could hear. When Sheen again appeared to be fatiguing, she commenced pushing back harder against him and moaning louder, telling him he was bigger, harder, stronger, more virile than any man alive. It was like a coxswain calling out encouragement to the rowers to get them to accelerate their strokes. Sheen, thus puffed up, obliged her, but he was so unsteady on his feet he bumped into the nightstand and knocked both a half-filled glass and a Bible onto the floor. In short order, the flabby man, thus inspired, finished his business and slumped over her, his massive weight forcing the woman down flat on the bed. Her expression was now one of irritation coupled with relief. Archer watched as she wriggled out from under him. Then she turned, smiled, and patted his cheek.
Oh my God, Wilson, I'm gonna be walking funny for a week.
He rubbed her cheek, smiled, and then promptly fell asleep. She quickly rose, dressed fast, and headed for the door without even bothering to cover him with a sheet. Her glance back at the sleeping man was full of disgust. Archer closed the ceiling door and retraced his steps to Fraser's door. He looked out in time to see Darling's backside as she headed down the hall. Her stockings' seams were all off-center, but everything else seemed to be in place. Archer fell in behind the woman and trailed her back to the first floor. She went to the check girl to get her hat, a little pillbox number the color of her dress, with a little black veil tacked up. While she was doing that, Archer spotted the cocktail waitress who had served him and Kemper earlier and asked her a couple of questions. She answered them, and he passed her a buck in thanks. She stuck it down her blouse, eyed him, and said,
Well, I get off at 1, if you're interested.
Thanks, but I got other plans.
Geez, I can't buy a man tonight.
She flounced off, and Archer hustled over to claim his hat while Darling was adjusting hers.
Well, funny meeting you here, he said to Darling.
She quickly turned.
Mr. Archer.
I thought this place was built mainly for the guys.
Her gaze inadvertently ventured upward, all the way, Archer thought,
to the room where Sheen was now peacefully sleeping off probably the best sex of his life. She blushed beautifully and looked back at him.
I was meeting a friend, and I come here for a drink now and then.
Oh, well, then I'll leave you to it.
No, I mean, I've met my friend and we're all done now.
Well, then how about that drink we talked about?
What? Oh, all right. What the hell?
That's what I like to hear from a gal. What the hell? He was rewarded with a crimsoning of her cheeks. They got their drinks, he a beer and she a gin and tonic. He led her out to the rear entrance, and they occupied the same chairs he and Kemper had used earlier. So was your friend one of the gals in the office? He said.
Yes. Sally. We had a drink.
You like working for Mr. Kemper?
It's a job. I like the conditions.
I guess you spend more time with Wilson Sheen, though. She glanced sharply at him, searching his features for some telltale sign that his words meant something more. But Archer had prepared himself and gave nothing away. I mean, that's why he has Sheen, right, to handle stuff for him?
Yes, that's right. I do deal with Mr. Sheen more.
She pulled out a pack of Paul Moles, and he lit one for her. Her hand trembled. She took a puff and said,
Why were you meeting with him?
Something to do with Kemper's campaign. We're helping him out. She said derisively,
If he can't beat a damn dentist, he doesn't deserve the job.
Right. So you come here often?
Once or maybe twice a week. For a drink, like I said.
You ever run across a gal named Ruby Fraser?
Was she the one who was killed here? I read about it in the paper.
She was. So did you know her? She tapped her ash into the ashtray a little too hard. It was like a toddler banging his toy against the wall right before she went truly berserk.
No. No, I didn't.
I spoke with Kemper earlier. He was here. We sat at this very table. Her eyes opened wider with interest.
Really? What did you talk about?
Just business. He said Wilson Sheen was here, too. Have you seen him? I think I spotted him a while ago. I wanted to talk to him as well.
Mr. Sheen? No. No, I haven't seen him. If he was here, he might have left. I find he tires easily.
Archer observed she had to struggle to keep the smile off her face. Finally, she looked away from him and drank her gin and tonic nearly to the bottom of the glass. Now, that's too bad. So how's business?
We're very busy. Mr. Kemper has his fingers in lots of pies.
Do you know his wife?
I've seen her.
She's quite beautiful.
You know, Archer, the gal you're with is the one you should be complimenting.
He grinned. Sorry, you don't need to tell me that you're quite the looker.
That's better, and I do need you to tell me.
Okay, you're quite the looker. You stood out from the other gals in the office like a flamingo in the desert.
First time I've been compared to a flamingo, but I'll take it. Even though those gals are younger than me, Archer?
Even though. She looked over his shoulder, and her gaze caught on something. When Archer turned to look, all he saw was a waitress setting down a shrimp cocktail in front of an old man with a gal half his age on his lap. You know them? Asked Archer.
He's a client of Mr. Kemper. Owns some property Kemper is trying to develop. His wife wouldn't like what he's doing right now.
I guess not.
So why do you want to talk to Sheen?
Part of the investigation. After this drink, I'm going to try to find him. He must be around here somewhere. I'll roust him. She ran her eye up and down him to such an invasive degree that Archer felt his own cheeks start to burn.
Why don't we blow this joint, Archer? My place is only 20 minutes from here.
But what about Sheen?
Come by the office tomorrow. You can talk to him then. He's there every day, and this time, I won't make you wait.
So what are we going to do at your place? She gave him a look that raised one distinct possibility.
If I can't think of something, and you can't think of something, then something is very wrong, mister.
I've got a car.
Good, because I don't.
Do you mind if I ask you a few questions along the way?
Not so long as we get to where we're really going at the end.
Chapter 49
This is your car? Really?
she said, as the valet brought it up. Archer flipped the kid a quarter and held the door for her. Yeah, it is.
Shouldn't I be getting in the other side?
The Brits do it differently from us, he replied.
So this is a British car?
No, it's actually French, but it's a long story and not that exciting.
Come on, where'd you get this ride?
Won it in a poker game back in Reno.
Wow, you must be really good,
she said.
Maybe I'll find out.
He smiled at her. You know, you have a whole other persona at work.
At work, everyone has to be someone they're not. I'm no exception. And I'm a gal who likes to have fun in her off hours. All work and no play makes poor Wilma very dull indeed.
Okay.
So what questions do you have?
You ever see Kemper when you're at Midnight Moods? I understand that he's a regular.
I see him sometimes. He plays cards. They only let men in there.
Yeah, I saw that. How come?
They don't want to lose to women, that's how come.
You ever see him with Ruby Fraser?
How should I know? I don't know what she looks like.
Archer described the woman for her.
Well, that sounds like half the women who work there.
She noted. Yeah, I guess it does.
Why are you interested in her and Mr. Kemper?
Part of the business I'm doing with him.
You think he was messing around with her? He's a married man.
He ever mess with you? She shook her head.
To tell you the truth, Archer, I think he's in love with his wife.
You're the first one to say that, and that includes him and his wife.
Some of the gals at work have given it their best shot with the man and came away with zip for their troubles.
What about Sheen?
What about him?
You or the other girls ever make a run at him?
Maybe some of the other gals, but I don't like to bake, Archer.
What does that mean? He said with a puzzled expression.
I don't enjoy sticking my fingers in dough.
She let out a throaty laugh that was so spontaneous and unexpected that Archer couldn't help but join her.
Hey, you look like a man who carries a pocket flask, and I need a drink.
He pulled it out and handed it across. She took a long sip and screwed the top back on before handing it back to him. She directed him to her place, a one-story bungalow on the fringes of Baytown, in a quiet, tree-lined neighborhood of like abodes. Like much of Baytown, it smacked of Spanish influence, with stucco walls, wrought iron railings that were starting to rust from the salt air and stain the stucco, and a peaked terracotta tile roof. The front door was dark oak, with black, strappy metal adornments. She slid the key in, and Archer followed her inside. Nice place, he said, looking around at the comfortable and plush furnishings, the colorful oriental rug, the full mahogany bar set against one wall, with crystal glasses set on top, and neat rows of bottles, along with a cocktail shaker and jiggers set that looked well used. She put her hat and purse on the coffee table and spun around to look at him, her fingers playing over the belt around her waist.
I'm going to freshen up. Help yourself to a drink. I've got cigarettes in that bowl over there.
Thanks. What can I have ready for you?
Oh, we'll think of something when I get back.
She departed the room, and a minute later, he heard the shower start. Part of Archer wanted to just walk out the door. He was investigating a case that had to do with the man Darling was working for. He had observed her having sex with that man's associate for reasons Archer did not yet know. Professionally, he told himself, it was better that he just walk away now. But he didn't, because he wanted to find out why she'd slept with the man. At least Archer told himself that was the only reason. He poured himself a bourbon neat, lit up a cigarette, and walked around the room. He eyed Darling's purse and took a few moments to examine the contents. He was really getting into this Seamus thing. There was a money clip with $20 worth of mad money, the pack of Pall Malls, a small pewter hip flask about half full, a lighter with a D engraved on it, and several ivory boxes that were empty, and a nickel-plated .22 Derringer with oak grips. It was loaded with 4 bullets and hadn't been recently fired, if Archer's sense of smell was any indicator. He heard the shower stop, and he put the items back in the purse and placed it exactly where it had been before. He moved over to the window, where there was a single street lamp burning brightly, but trying and failing to break through the marine fog rolling in. This place reminded Archer of London. Some days you could barely see a foot in front of you. He was still standing there looking out when she came back into the room. Darling had on a robe that was even more transparent than Archer's thoughts at the moment. Barefoot, she approached, a lioness to the lion, and it was not up for debate which would prevail. "You freshen up better than anyone I know," he began. She took his drink from him and set it down. She pulled his cigarette from his lips and took a long drag on it before bending down and tapping it out in the ashtray. "You don't like to beat around the bush, I take it," he said.
"Life's short, so I don't have time to waste."
"You're young?"
"We're all young, Archer. Right up to the minute we're just a picture on the wall for someone to remember."
She put her arms around him and pressed both her body and her lips against his.
"As soon as I saw you at the office, Archer, I started having thoughts about you."
She pulled away for a moment, looking at him.
"You seem like you'd be good to a woman."
"I try to be good to everyone."
"You gonna kiss me back, or do I have to place an order for delivery?"
"You know, I am investigating a case."
"Investigate me as much as you want."
"We probably shouldn't be doing this." She kissed him so hard he tasted both the gin and the lucky. It was an earthy combo. She took his hand and led him out of the room and into her bedroom, and there didn't seem to be a thing Archer could do about it. Darling let the robe fall to the floor. Though he had seen her naked with Sheen, the woman's figure still left him breathless, particularly this close up. And there went any possibility of his walking out on her. What had Kemper said? "I'm a man, Archer. I'm not saying I'm any better than I am in that regard." God help me, thought Archer. She helped him undress, and they slid into bed together. After that, it was a frantic 20 minutes of copulation that Archer wasn't even sure he could understand, much less rationalize. He wasn't one to jump into bed with a woman he barely knew, although this wasn't the first time he had done it. But Darling took control from the very start and never relinquished it. He was no babe when it came to sex, but the lady was clearly a few levels above him in that department. Archer felt like he'd been hit by a Mack truck, in the best possible sense, even as her nails gouged his back and slid all the way down to his butt. Later they lay together on top of the sheet, soaked in each other's sweat. Her lungs heaving, and her body still twitching, she stroked his chest and panted,
"Good God, Archer. How long since you've been with a woman anyway, mister?"
"Too long, apparently. And just for the record, you threw in a few moves that were new to me."
"See? That's what you get for going to bed with a mature woman."
"Yeah, a mature wildcat, more like." She sat up and played with his chest hairs while giving him a heavy-lidded once-over.
"If I let you stay the night, you think you might be up for a repeat performance before breakfast? They say exercise helps the appetite, and I make a killer cup of joe."
"I like coffee. A lot." She smacked him playfully on the cheek, and then French kissed him. She pulled her lips away and breathed in his ear,
"Mine's good to the very last drop, sweetie."
They slept heavily, and when they woke early the following morning, Darling slid on top of him, and they went for round two. After that, they slept for another hour, and she made him a cup of coffee and 2 fried eggs with toast. He showered, and when he got out, he found her pressing his clothes while stark naked. He dressed and was giving her a kiss, his hand around her bare waist, and thinking about maybe going back to bed for extra innings, when her phone rang. And everything in the world changed. Chapter 50 Archer and Dash were in the Delahaye on the way to Midnight Moods. He had called Dash from Darling's bungalow and filled him in on the call Darling had gotten earlier that morning. Then he had driven over to the office. Dash said,
"Who found the body?"
Douglas Kemper told Wilma Darling that a maid found Wilson Sheen dead in a room at Midnight Moods.
"Which room?"
"If I had to guess, it would be the one next to Fraser's."
"If you had to guess?
Let me fill you in." Archer told Dash everything about the night before, including meeting with Kemper and learning about Beth's apartment in town and seeing Sheen and Darling together in bed. "And in the crawl space in the ceiling, I found some bloodstains."
"So that's how they moved her body," said Dash thoughtfully. "From that room, through the attic access,
and into Fraser's room. How the hell did the coppers not see that possibility? How did I not see it? I must be getting blind in my old age.
Well, I didn't see it either the first time around. And who would think to move a dead body through the attic?
Well, the room where Fraser was killed probably has another body in it. Did Kemper say how Sheen was killed?
No.
And you were with Wilma Darling when Kemper called?
Yes.
Did she say how he sounded?
Frantic was the word she used. You think Pickett will be out for this one, too?
Carl can't find his teeth before 9 o'clock.
They arrived at Midnight Moods to find prowlers everywhere, along with the coroner's wagon. Ernie Prettyman was standing outside the room where Sheen had been found.
How'd you hear so fast, Willie? Asked a surprised Prettyman. I've only been here an hour myself.
Friend of a friend, replied Dash. Can we see the body?
Prettyman led them into the room where Wilson Sheen lay on his stomach, with a sheet partially covering him.
How'd he die? Asked Dash.
Prettyman lifted the sheet, revealing a wide, bloody wound in the middle of the back.
Knife to the heart, quick, silent, and efficient.
Was he here alone? Asked Dash.
It was clear that he had been with someone.
A woman, you mean?
Yes. Dash said.
Archer found the way that they shifted Fraser's body from here to there.
Archer led the way next door to Fraser's room and showed Prettyman the ceiling access door. It runs over to the next room where Sheen was killed. I found bloodstains up there that might be Fraser's. Her room is the last in the corridor, so that's the only room that's next to hers. Prettyman looked at the door, and then at Dash, and then at Archer.
You found this last night?
Yes. What time?
Around 10.
Coroner thinks Sheen bought it around 11.
Prettyman glanced at Dash, and then eyed Archer.
So it's interesting that you were here around that time, right next door. And more than that, in the space over where the murder took place.
Dash said, Okay, Ern, you got every right to ask questions and put the screws to Archer because he was here around the time in question, but he's got no motive to kill Sheen. We were working for his boss.
Motives are funny things, Willie. They can turn on a dime if you look at things at a different angle.
He paused.
I'm sure you remember telling me that.
I do, and you're right. But Archer won't be leaving town. I give you my word on that. So he'll be around to answer any other questions you might have. But just to add my 2 cents, the guy who killed Sheen is not in this room right now.
Ern nodded slowly. Okay, but I have to do my job.
Yes, you do.
Dash glanced at Archer before saying,
Has this room been assigned to anyone here either now or in recent history?
I checked on that. Mabel Dawson said the last occupant was a vaudeville performer, but he left about a week ago. No one's been in there since.
Prettyman glanced at Archer.
So you didn't see or hear anyone while you were poking around up there?
Ern, come on. What do you think?
Said Dash, drawing a look from Archer, who was careful to avoid Prettyman's eye.
Now we need to find the connection between Fraser and Sheen.
If there is one, said Prettyman.
We've both been doing this a long time. 2 stiffs coming from the same room? There's a connection, all right.
Any chance of your telling me who your client is now?
About the same odds as yesterday. Look, me and Archer have to get going. Things are rolling fast now, and I don't like playing catch-up.
Okay, but remember, Archer doesn't leave town.
Dash and Archer made their way quickly down the steps and outside.
What was the deal back there? Said Archer.
You pretty much lied to the police.
This line of work requires balance, Archer, and if you look at what I said, you'll find that I threaded that needle as well as it could be. Ern is a good guy, but he's by the book, meaning whatever we tell him goes straight to Carl Pickett's ear, and right now, I don't want Carl knowing what we know.
Right.
One thing Wilma Darling said does surprise me, noted Dash.
Just one? Then you're a better man than me.
She said she really thought Kemper loved his wife.
Archer looked intrigued.
Yeah, and I believed her when she said it. And talking to the guy, well...
Well, what?
Archer said, Some guys are genuine Lotharios, and some guys want others to think they are. I believe Kemper falls into the latter group. He just tries too hard, but then never seals the deal. I talked to the cocktail waitress who served us last night. It was pretty clear to me that he could have had her for the price of a Coke. She told me Kemper didn't even ask what time she got off when she came back to pick up his empty drink.
And I wonder when he actually left, and what he was doing between the time he left you and then left this place.
What motive would he have to kill his second lieutenant and campaign manager? Asked Archer.
I'm not looking purely for motives right now. I'm looking for connections. 9 times out of 10, when you do that, the motives become apparent.
They climbed into the Delahaye and set off back to town.
Drop me off at my garage. I'm getting my car back today. Then I want you to go and talk to Wilma Darling and see what you can get out of her, namely, who put her up to jumping Sheen's bones last night. Call the office when you have something.
Okay. What will you be doing besides getting your car?
Dash said, putting the pieces together. Gumshoeing sort of requires that.